Court. My name is Michael Bigelow, and I represent Mr. Bonner. On the issue of obstruction, I got no idea. That's because it's the state of the document. The law says that it is a bona fide case, as a condition, a bona fide domestic condition is entitled to be investigated. The question I've got is, who makes the determination whether it's bona fide? And at what point does it matter in this case?
Well, isn't it informed by what the BOP psychologists report to the district court? It was like a 42-page opinion. It was pretty detailed.
Because that's the investigation.
Right, but that informs the district court as the ultimate finder of fact. It's like the proof on which the court relies in making the factual finding that your client was malingering.
That's the end product.
Correct.
Who makes the initial determination that it should be investigated in the first place?
The statute provides that it can be either the court or counsel or both, but ultimately it's the court who orders the 42-48 evaluation.
Exactly. With the person who makes that determination in this case, initially, trial counsel said, my client is mentally incompetent. She made the initial determination. Her determination was a bona fide determination. It was sincere. It was sincere.
There's a question that your client or your lawyer was acting in good faith. The problem is that you've got a factual finding that after however many weeks or months of evaluation, the psychologist tested him and the test came back showing he was malingering. That's not on trial counsel. That's on the client.
Maybe it's not. All of those facts are there. But we've got a lawyer. We've got a trial lawyer who's a lawyer, not a psychiatrist, not a psychologist. She's got no idea. This guy presents to her. He doesn't say, I'm crazy. He doesn't say, I want to be found incompetent.
We don't know what he said to her.
Exactly.
She was the one who came to the court and said, I've got some real concerns about my client.
Correct. Now, had she not come to the court, I would pay a nickel for every habeas I've been involved in over the years. Every case I've been involved in over the years, where down the road, the lawyer says, or the judge says, or somebody says, you know, this guy really should have been evaluated way, way, way back when. Okay? So you got a lawyer who says, okay, this guy needs to be evaluated. And so they ship him off. Now, the client, we don't know what the client says because we didn't have a hearing on it. We didn't have any kind of an evidence.
I'm not sure that the client or that the lawyer would want to admit in evidence the things that the client had been telling him, which he
well,
and I guess in specific areas of attorney-client.
He gets down by submitting him to this evaluation. By submitting him to this evaluation, she exposes him to two levels, to an obstruction of justice. Okay. Now, apparently she was dead wrong. She shouldn't have done it. Based on the information we have.
What we know of that would be a full term.
We don't know that, do we?
Well, I don't understand your position. Are you conceding that malingering can be the basis for an obstruction of justice that is
also
a failure to comply with those who are trying to conduct a commentary?
Those are two questions, Your Honor. Those are two questions. Can malingering be? Yes, malingering can be.
Malingering can be the basis for an obstruction of justice.
Yes.
And so if there is a supported finding that he did not cooperate with those who are trying to conduct the competency evaluation, he could be subject to a malingering obstruction of justice.
Maybe not malingering. Maybe he is. Maybe. We don't know. Maybe. Your Honor, maybe his refusal to participate in the testing the evaluation. Maybe his refusal was, hey, my lawyer railroaded me into this thing. I'm not crazy. I'm here because she wanted me here. I don't want to participate. I'm not crazy. If I participate, I'm telling them I'm crazy. If I don't participate, I'm telling them I'm not.
But the finding of lingering was made on more than his refusal to cooperate with the test. It was also made on the differences that the custodial staff recognized between how he interacted with other inmates when the doctors were around and how he interacted when the psychologist came in to evaluate.
Let's talk about that for just a moment. Perhaps, we don't know this, perhaps staff has got this guy in the room and they're doing the evaluation and they're saying, you know, this guy should never have been here. Why is he here in the first place? He got here because he malingered early on. He convinced his lawyer, that he was incompetent. He was insane. He should never be here. At what point does the malingering begin? I know what the PSR says. The PSR evaluates it only on what staff determine. Okay? Well, only local.
I don't think that's accurate.
What rule are you proposing? You said malingering is sufficient to find an obstruction. So, what rule are you proposing that if the lawyer is the one that petitions the court, then it can't be used, but if the client petitions the court, it can? What was the rule? Because you know, admitting that it can be obstruction, so I'm trying to find the line you draw.
I'm admitting that malingering can be obstruction. Yes. Cases say they can, and this court's not going to But I think that the district court ought to be very clear about what actually constitutes the malingering. Did the malingering occur initially in the district court? Was he feigning insanity, for lack of a better term, in the district court, and somehow convinced his lawyer to go to the court?
I may interrupt you. I'm a district judge, so I want to know who you come in to me, and I'm sitting there, and I want to know what I'm supposed to do when the lawyer tells me they have a concern about the conflict.
So you base it on counsel? What do you base that on, counsel? Counsel, if you had him examined, did you get a CJA appointment for a psychiatrist to have him evaluated? You're not a psychiatrist for your counsel.
But that's the same thing that happened here.
No.
You're suggesting that the court should first allow the defense to conduct an in-camera evaluation of its own and then decide whether or not they're going to release the results. Let me ask my question. And then decide whether or not the defense lawyer wants to release the results to the court. Is that what you're asking?
It's not in the district court. I can request experts. As a CJA counsel, I can request experts to be appointed.
What was the objection that was made in the district court to what might happen to
him? That he was malingering under whatever rules are applicable, that the finding was inapplicable if there was insufficient evidence to support malingering. See, the problem I have with this, Your Honor, is look, the problem I have with this is we don't know where the malingering, what the focus of the malingering was. Was it malingering because of what Steph said, or is it? Or what Steph said?
You make the determination of malingering by your own admission, and it's a legitimate basis to order an enhancement. I'm not sure, as a matter of law, what difference it made.
Because I'm not convinced it was actually malingering in this case.
If you take the position you do, and the report comes back that he's malingering, and the probation office says it's going to recommend that the obstruction be applied, you now have a factual issue, which is what's he malingering about, and you disagree with the report. Why wouldn't you have then? It wasn't you, I assume. That's why I wouldn't have defense lawyers here. We ought to look into this. I mean, you bring that malingering within the law, and I'm going to put my own psychiatrist up to show that what happened is this, but when you have a factual issue, once you have the report and the probation department document, then it seems to me prima facie shows what the government suggests, but you have an opportunity to contest it. There's nothing to contest it.
But a lot of his lingering was the finding, rather. A lot of the finding was based on his refusal to participate in the examination. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's only part of it. You keep overlooking all the other evidence that's recounted in the report of how he behaved outside the presence of a testing environment.
That doesn't necessarily mean, number one, that he's crazy. And number two, it doesn't mean that he's wondering. I mean, there are crazy people
who are saying, looks at the totality of all the evidence before it. And frankly, by my read of the report, it's a pretty strong record to support the district court's factual finding that he was. So if your argument is essentially there isn't enough evidence in that report to justify the district court's finding, I'm having a hard time declaring that clear error on appellate review.
I think that that was the objection that was made at the trial, so I don't think that it is clear error.
Well, it has to be clear error. It's not as a factual finding. Okay. Well, let's hear from the government. You can use up your time. I'll give you a couple minutes.
That's right.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Matthew Morris. I represent the United States, and I was counsel for the government in the court below. I do want to just correct one perhaps misperception the court might have gotten from the argument a moment ago. There was never an objection to the diagnosis of malignant. There's no factual dispute either in this court or the court below. Judge Quigley, as you pointed out, there was the opportunity. If the defendant wanted to contest the diagnosis, he could have contested what was said in the report. He could have contested the facts that were contained in the PSR. He never did either.
What did you understand the objection to have been?
A series of legal objections, Your Honor. There are basically three arguments that I read that are varying levels of robustness. One was an argument about a finding of competence should not lead to the obstruction enhancement, and we agree that that was what happened here. It was not a finding of competence. It was a finding of malingering, which is different. The second argument was just one sentence, which was, there's no evidence that was done with the intent to delay. That's not contained either in the plain language of Section 3C1.1 or in any of the application notes. It certainly isn't in any court's precedent on this. The third argument was the one that was the most robust, but even then it took up about a page and a half, and that's this Chilean argument that by punishing a defendant for false information in the competency evaluation, it is going to chill the defense attorney's counseling of that defendant with respect to his constitutional rights. That argument really is disposed of with Donegan from the Supreme Court. The same argument was made there in the context of applying obstruction for perjury. And the Supreme Court said, nonsense, you have the constitutional right to testify, you don't have a constitutional right to testify falsely. Likewise here, the defendant has the constitutional right not to be held to trial if he represents. He does not have a constitutional right to present false information as part of that process. That is what was discussed in the PSR. All of this talk about what might have happened between him and his lawyer is not relevant in this case. The PSR applied the enhancement based upon, quote, presentation of false information about his mental health condition as part of a court ordered psychiatric examination.
Yes, folks, please stop here for just a second. Why did the government not supply the court with a copy of the actual evaluation report as part of your excerpts or supplemental excerpt of record? It seems to me that it's a breaching piece of evidence to help inform the court as to whether or not the district court erred.
Yes, for that, Your Honor, the only portions of that report which were raised below are before the court. So that's within the government's supplemental interest of record.
We obtained a copy of the full report that was filed under seal, and it was clearly transmitted to the district court, and it was the subject of the discussion at sentencing. It's actually quoted at length, I think, in the government sentencing memorandum. So why didn't you give us the entire exhibit that was before the district court at sentencing?
I thought we had included the portions that had been discussed both by the PSR and by the supplemental
records. All we had was the arguments and the memos and the briefs.
That's what I'm referring to, Your Honor. So no, we didn't file the extra file.
And I'm suggesting to you, don't do that again.
Yes, sir.
Give us a full record.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Moving on again, the defendant never objected to any of the facts on them. Nothing contained in paragraph 16, the PSR was a subject of fact in dispute, and it was never disputed either the opening brief or the reply brief here. In fact, he conceded below that he refused to take part in portions of it. Our position below was that under Fontana, that could have supported the obstruction enhancement all by itself, but we also argued that the malingering, even if he had complied with everything and had malingered, that also, in alignment with all of the other circuits that have looked at this, that's also sufficient under the law. And finally, Your Honor, the discretion of chilling the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Greer takes it in more depth and analyzes it extensively. Every circuit that's looked at it since then has reached the same conclusion, which is there's no chilling here because whatever happened between him and his lawyer prior to the court's order, the defendant faced a fork in the road once he was at the BOP facility. He can continue whatever charade he'd been playing with his lawyer, or he can be truthful. These are now people who are trying to obtain information for the district judge so that the district judge can determine and follow his constitutional obligations when he chose to present false information to those officers and people who are acting on behalf of the court. That was when he committed a search of justice. I'll turn briefly to the distribution for Thing of Value unless there are any other questions about the instruction advancement. On the distribution for a thing of value, the only argument made here was that there should have been a Rule 32 proceeding. Under this court's precedence of Carter and Christensen and Petrie, the only time Rule 32 hearings are appropriate is when a specific fact in the PSR is challenged as being inaccurate. That never happens here. The PSR, paragraph 19, is the relevant paragraph. It states that the defendant, in the course of trading child pornography with another person, there is this exchange where the other person says, do you have girl stuff? The defendant says, I can give you girl stuff. I have lots of girl stuff, but can you give me boy stuff? That is exactly what the guy might say is an exchange for a thing of value. The only argument made below is that there is no evidence of transferring money. That's a different enhancement. It's explicitly covered in the guidelines that giving child pornography in exchange for expecting child pornography in return is applicable to other 2G2.2. So there's no other questions, Your Honor. I'd simply ask this. On the question of instruction, we would ask this court to align itself with all the other circuits. It sounds like the defendant here in argument has conceded that malingering can be a basis for instruction. And then on the question of both enhancements, we'd ask the court to affirm the sentence that was imposed by Judge Lucas. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I'll give you a couple minutes in rebuttal if you'd like. Mr. Spiegel.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take up the hearing. But anyway, the only point that I would make that I didn't earlier, and the counsel alluded to or mentioned, is the chilling effect of it. I guarantee you that as a trial lawyer, I ain't ever going to refer somebody to. For a formal commitment. Unless I spend more CJA money getting them evaluated first to make sure that I'm not going to run afoul of obstruction.
But as a good defense lawyer, if you had a good faith belief that your client was not competent to be prosecuted, I can't believe that you wouldn't bring that issue to the court. Maybe it would be in the form of a motion for expert witness fees to have him evaluated by your own expert.
That's different than what happened here. That is exactly what I would do. If I have a good faith belief, then I wouldn't do it without good faith. I would never spend CGA money with him.
But good faith, of course. Yeah, and of course that is good.
No, I'm going to have him evaluated, but that's not good practice.
But I guess my inherent my question is that there is risk in every choice that a trial lawyer makes with regard to the prosecution or defense. defense on a case. And you know that it's a calculated risk that you have to take sometimes. You may not like the results.
I'm making up the number. I don't know what the percentage is. The percentage of findings of incompetence under the federal system, the way that we've done it over the years, is really, really, really low. So let's say it's 30%. 70% are going to be found to be competent. So I run the risk. I run the risk of some staffer saying, not saying malingering. He may be right. I run that risk. If I ain't going to do that, my client, I'm going to take other steps. Thank you very much. I appreciate the court's
attention. Thank you for the argument, counsel. The case just argued is submitted.